rooms, I'll have these two focus lectures on gravitational physics. And the focus lectures basically supplement the lecture. So there will be a little bit more than was done in the lecture, or perhaps from a different perspective, what was done in the lecture. So the aim of today's lecture is actually to show you that the Einstein equations, which are written here, and they're sort of motivated in the lecture, follow from some nice argument and can be sort of derived by very nice mathematical argument. So before how I do that, I just remind you what these Einstein equations are. So on the left-hand side, and I omitted the lambda term here, so I just put lambda equal to zero with respect to the lecture. So it has basically geometry. So it has some curvature tensor here and the Ricci scalar, and all these depend on the metric. Whereas on the right-hand side, you have everything which regards the matter. So this is an energy momentum tensor for the matter. And so if you want to solve this, usually you solve these equations for the metric. So metric describes your space-time and is the dynamical variable in general relativity. And so if you want to regard this equation, so g mu depends on the metric itself, on the first derivative of the metric and second derivative of the metric. So what this is actually partial differential equation for the metric, second order partial differential equation. And now indices mu and nu, if you are in four dimensions, they run from 0 to 3. So you have 0, 1, 2, 3, so four indices in each mu and nu. So you have 4 times 4 matrix, basically, here. But there is a symmetry. So mu, the equation is symmetric in mu nu. So then you have basically 4 by 4 matrix, which is symmetric, and that has 10 components. So these equations actually represent 10 equations of motion for the metric g mu nu. So now, what people usually like about these equations is that they play double agent role. Okay, double agent. And so what does it mean is that first, you can look at these equations like I'm providing what t mu nu is, so I'm fixing the matter. So first, fix t mu nu, so say, you know, what is the distribution of the matter field, if you want, and then solve for g mu nu. This is not so straightforward because, as Veronica told you, t mu nu usually also depends on g mu nu, but yeah, so solve for g mu nu for the metric. And so if you look at this equation in this way, then basically what you are saying is that matter tells space-time how to curve. So g mu nu describes how the space-time is curved. So this you can read, matter tells space-time how to curve. So that's one meaning of the Einstein equation. Well, let's see if this works. No, it doesn't work anymore, okay. The second point of view is that actually now you can massage this equation, and there is an interesting identity which is satisfied. So this is, okay, so that identity is nabla mu g mu nu equals to zero. It's an identity called Bianchi identity. So here nabla mu stands for a covariant derivative. It's basically like a partial derivative plus these Christoffel symbols which you've seen in the lecture. But anyway, take it just as a derivative. So you differentiate your g mu nu, sum over this index mu, and then for any metric, you get equal to zero. So this is always true. So however, what does it mean, what does it imply when I apply nabla mu on both sides of this equation? So if I apply nabla mu on the left-hand side, I get zero. So on the right-hand side, I must get also zero. But 8 pi gn is just a constant. So
wait,
what
is
implied?
Wait, so the Bianchi identity is just a mathematical fact. It's not a...
Exactly.
And it would apply to any tensor or what?
So this g mu nu depends on the metric.
Yeah.
Right? So no matter which metric you choose.
Okay.
For computational metric, this will always be true. It's just an identity.
But that's specific to g mu nu as defined...
As r mu nu minus 1/2 r g mu nu.
Oh, all right. It's specific to that expression.
Exactly. All right. Yeah. So this is just a mathematical identity,
yep.
But what it follows from the consistency that this must be true. Mm-hmm. Okay, but what this actually is an equation of motion for the matter.
Okay.
Okay, so what does it mean actually is that you can read the Einstein equation also another way, is that the space-time tells the matter how to move. Because once the Einstein equation holds, you know how the matter moves in the space-time. Yes?
That's not conservation of energy momentum?
Sort of is, but more is an equation of motion. We can discuss, it's a very profound issue, this
in
one.
In flat space?
In flat space, yes. In flat space, yes. In curved space, it's something different.
There's no forces besides gravity, so those are the same thing, right? Conservation of momentum is going to just tell you that you're following a few distances.
But
suppose there were, you know, suppose another man had interaction between them.
Well, in some sense, you're right. So in some sense, it's a local conservation of energy. But from local conservation of energy, usually the equations of motion follow. And there was a huge discussion of this in, you know, 60s and 70s. But yeah, so this is basically an equation of motion for matter. But you are right. If you are in flat space, it's just a conservation of energy, if you want. Okay, so it plays basically this double agent role. So not only tells you, you know, how to curve the space-time if you have matter, but also tells you how the matter moves for a given space-time. Yes?
So if you have like your matter that, for example, is made of charges or whatever, and the charges are interacting, there's some equations of motion, and these are like extra to this, or?
Not really. That's the amazing thing here. So sometimes, yes, but usually, so for example, if I have a particle, so what you've seen is that there's a geodesic equation, for example, and that tells you, you know, if I have a test particle, how this particle moves in a curved space, for example. So now you're saying, well, there's this geodesic equation which tells me how the particle moves, but at the same time, I need to solve for the geometry using Einstein equations, provided that I know the distribution of the things. What actually turns out that this thing actually gives you the geodesic equation. You can show that. If I have T mu nu for distribution of particles, then this equation is geodesic equation or generalization of the geodesic equation. Okay?
But that's assuming that gravity is the only force, right?
No. Well, no. If you have electromagnetism, well, it's a little bit more complicated than that, but yeah. If you have complicated additional forces, it's not so straightforward. You're right.
Can we interpret this a little more? Like the terms of this stress energy tensor, the entries in it, meaning like the amount of they talk about the amount of flow of matter through going in different orthogonal
That's
directions
right, yeah.
at a point. Okay, and then what is this equation saying? It's saying that just the sum of all the matter coming in equals the sum of all the matter going out.
Yeah.
It's okay, but if that's all it's saying, then it seems like there could be many different ways of solving that for the same configuration of matter.
Right. Unless you have weird forces, there is only one way. But okay.
So that's assuming that you know the flow of the.
No.
I mean, all right.
Yeah. Well, it's a miracle. It's a miracle here. So usually if you have field theory, you need two types of equations. You need equations of motion, mm-hmm. and you need field equations.
Yeah.
That's the case, for example, for Maxwell theory. For gravity, it's more restrictive. Actually, it turns out that the Einstein equations are everything basically you need, if you have nice matter distribution. Okay, so now what Veronica mentioned is that these equations were actually, derived by Einstein from a very physics intuitive point of view. And so basically he was generalizing Newton's gravity and, looking at weak field approximation. And basically he started from here. So he knew that the matter must be conserved. And then he was looking for the left-hand side, which is also conserved. So Einstein did, very intuitive way. Einstein did physical intuitive derivation. Basically starting from this equation and motivating what this equation has to be. But of course, he was beaten and scooped by Hilbert. So he wasn't the first one to write down these equations. It was actually Hilbert. So Hilbert wasn't interested in physics. He basically was interested in pure mass derivation. And so derive this in mathematical way, mass way. And that was from the action principle. And he indeed beaten Einstein about a month or something like that. So Einstein delivered a seminar that he's looking for these equations, and he pretty much knew what the equations should look like. But then Hilbert published whatever. So he wrote down these equations about a month earlier than Einstein did. Okay. So it's the aim of this lecture to actually show you the other way, this more precise mathematical way how to derive these equations. And so let me just do the analogy. And this will be probably very trivial, but everybody has taken some course on classical mechanics. And so you know that the action in classical mechanics is just given by an integral over the Lagrangian, and the Lagrangian depends on the trajectory and the derivative of the trajectory, and you integrate this over dt, and this Lagrangian is something like kinetic energy minus potential energy, or whatever. And then if you vary this action with respect to the trajectory, and you require that the action is stationary, then this is what gives you the equations of motion. In particular, you get the Euler-Lagrange equations. Okay, so everybody knows that. So now, in field theory, it's pretty much the same. So let me take a scale of field theory, which depends on, so this is the trajectory of the particle. Then if I have field, then the action is now given by this thing here, where phi is my field. And then this thing, if you want, you can think about it like integration over time and space at the same time, and L is the Lagrangian density. And so pretty much in analogy, it depends on the field and on its derivative. In the same way as here, it depends on the trajectory and its derivative here. So now if you require delta phi, you vary the section with respect to delta phi and require delta s equals to zero, that gives you the equations of motion again. So as a specific example, if you have just massless scale field theory, then you have minus, which is basically a convention if you want, and then the mu of phi, and that's your Lagrangian density, which is like dt phi square minus the spatial derivatives of phi square. And if you write down this thing here, you get that your equations of motion are just a wave equation on your scale of field phi equals to zero. Okay, so is this new for somebody, or everybody is happy with this? Okay, so if everybody is happy with this, then okay, not everybody, but almost everybody. So let's try to do the same thing for gravity. And so in GR, you know that the field is geometric. Field is geometric, G alpha beta. That's your field. And so you want to construct a Lagrangian density out of the metric and its first derivative. So want to find the Lagrangian density, which depends on the metric and its first derivative, right? Precisely in the analogy of QQ dot and phi and d mu phi, right? So this is what I want. So now there's a problem. There is no such quantity whatsoever. So problem, is that there is no non-trivial scalar that can be constructed from just the metric and its first derivative. Okay, so this is related to something which is called equivalence principle. So Maybe if you've seen GR before, you know that basically what is related to derivatives of the metric is these Christoffel symbols, is these gammas, which you've seen in today's lecture, and you've seen the precise formula. But equivalence principle says that I can always go to a frame where these actually vanish. So this thing actually doesn't give me anything. It's not a tensor. I can always vanish it due to the equivalence principle. And so then you are looking, so basically that tells you that such function doesn't exist. It will just be a function of G, but that's trivial. If you want to construct a scale out of metric itself, it's just the trace of the metric, which is just a number, or you know, some power of the metric, but that's not interesting. So you cannot do that. But what you can do is that you have to add one more derivative to the metric. So there is a uniqueness theorem, which of course Hilbert knew uniqueness. And so there is a precisely one tensor, which is called the Riemann tensor, which again you have seen today. Riemann tensor, which is a unique tensor, unique object that can be constructed from the metric, its first derivative and its second derivative. So R alpha beta gamma delta is a function of the metric, the first derivative of the metric, and the second derivative of the metric. So you have to add one more derivative to the metric, and then you can find it. Okay. So you have also seen the specific expression in the lecture, which is something like a derivative of this gamma thing, minus gamma gamma, and then antisymmetrized over these things. But it's not very, you know, it's not important for us. Yes?
So what's the uniqueness theorem? There exists a unique tensor satisfying what property?
So if you want to construct, basically, well, if you go to higher derivatives of the metric, you can construct more tensors. But if you are interested in what you can construct out of metric, first derivative, second derivative, they basically uniqueness, that you are saying this is the only tensor there is. Of course, there are some contractions of this tensor as well. For example, the Ricci scalar or Ricci tensor, they are constructed out of this guy. But basically, this is everything there is.
I can populate this tensor using whatever function of the three derivatives that I want.
But the problem is that that won't be. Oh, it will be.
Will it be a tensor? I mean,
if I put a function of. It won't be a tensor, I think. So you can multiply it by a function of the metric, maybe, which itself is a tensor.
Oh, by tensor means something that's invariant.
Under something that behaves nicely, and yeah, okay, exactly. So once I have this Riemann tensor, what Veronica did is that she constructed a Ricci scalar, which is precisely the guy which appears in the Einstein equation, and that's given by a contraction of this Riemann tensor. So it's given by the Ricci tensor G alpha beta, where R alpha beta is just a contraction alpha gamma beta. So I take this tensor, I contract these two indices, which means I trace over these things here, and then I multiply by metric, and this is my Ricci scalar. Okay, so it's constructed out of the Riemann tensor, and basically, and that's the only scalar I can write down. Okay, so now here is your candidate, right? So you are looking for a function which is a scalar function. You cannot do this guy, but you can do of two derivatives, and there is only one such object, which is the Ricci scalar. Okay, so then there is no wonder that the Einstein-Hilbert action, as Hilbert showed us, is given by, and so now this is just a prefactor which is useful for later, and then d4 of x square root of g and the Ricci scalar. So this is the famous Einstein-Hilbert action. However, of course, Hilbert came up with this action first. So as I say, this is just a prefactor, numerical prefactor, which is not important at this point. So now you integrate d4 of x as you would do in any field theory. So now this is your Lagrangian density, is the Ricci scalar, and this guy is determinant of the metric, square root of that. So it's there to put that this thing doesn't change if you change coordinates. So you really have to multiply your volume element by square root of determinant of the metric so that if you change coordinates, it's still the same. Okay, so this guy is invariant under if you change coordinates from x to x prime. Yes?
So I actually didn't understand the problem. So why is it that there, like why, what was the bit about the equivalence principle there? Why is there no such
problem? Oh, I just, I haven't shown that. It's a big theorem to prove, okay. Right? But just take it for granted that you can always go to a frame, which is basically like free-falling frame. Mm-hmm. So if you start free-falling, you just see nearby yourself just a flat space. Mm-hmm. But the theorem says that, so I can always set G equal to eta, which is like G is really my flat metric. Okay. But at the same time, you can actually, there's enough freedom to do coordinate changes that you can also kill the first derivative of the metric.
And you really do mean partial, not covariance?
The partial. Yeah, partial. Yeah. So and that's called equivalence principle. And you know, it's a theorem to be shown. Okay. But I'm not showing it here. But it's really that I can always choose such a frame where this can be done. So, and that tells you, you know, if it were a tensor, if it's zero in one frame, it would have to be zero in any other frame. But this guy is not a tensor. So sometimes you see gravitational acceleration, sometimes you don't. Depends on which frame you are using. Okay, so here this G is not the metric, but it's determinant of the metric. Sorry for that notation, it's very common. So here I was using the full metric G alpha beta and derivative of G alpha beta and so on. And here I'm just using determinant of the metric. So just to confuse you a little bit more, but it's standard notation. Okay, so this is it. So this is what Hilbert did. And you know, he knew that it all follows from the mass. He didn't need any physics input into this. Okay, so now let us show that really this action gives you the right Einstein equations. Yes.
In principle, you could get a function of R, right?
In principle, yes. That's right. But in some sense, this is the simplest choice, if you want. It's the minimal simplest choice. I'll mention some other choices later. Okay, so that was part A, motivation. And okay, so part B is really to vary this, so variational problem. Okay, so what you want to do is that take this action as a function of the metric, and let's vary the metric. So what you have to do is you have to do delta G alpha beta. I'm choosing the G alpha beta with indices up. You can do it with indices down if you want to. I'll just do this one here. Okay, so what I need to do is I have to vary this thing. So delta of Einstein-Hilbert. So of course, this is just a constant. So I just put it here. And then this thing is just coordinates, so it doesn't depend on the metric. So I go through that guy, d4 of x. And then I have to vary everything which is inside. And that is square root of g. Okay. And now I'll just write the Ricci scale in the form of Ricci tensor and g alpha beta. So r alpha beta, g alpha beta. Okay. So this is definitely correct. So now you see delta is just like a normal derivative, right? So you are differentiating three terms. So you are applying the Leibniz rule. You will have three terms. Okay. So I have c to the 1 over 16 pi g newton d4 of x. And then, so let me first, let's say, differentiate this guy and the other two left untucked. So r alpha beta delta g alpha beta, that's the first term. Then let me differentiate this guy plus, and this is just a Ricci scalar, r delta square root of g. And then finally, the last term is plus square root of g g alpha beta delta r alpha beta. Okay, so three terms from the Leibniz rule. This is a really stupid blackboard. Okay, so now let me just say this is term number one, this is term number two, and this is term number three. So when you are varying things, you want to put it into a form where it's something times delta g alpha beta. So the first term is already in that form. So this guy is actually the simplest one, and I don't have to do any work with this one. Okay, so the second one, we will do some work, but it's relatively simple, as you will see. The third term is real pain. Okay, so let's not do it. Okay, so leave for later, because it's the most complicated one. And it's always the case, right? So you always try to postpone as much as you can the hard work. So let me do the term number two. Okay. And for that, I'll just use some mathematical identity, which you may find in any probably linear algebra textbook. So use identity. So if you have a matrix A, then if you differentiate that matrix, well, the determinant of that matrix is given by the determinant of that matrix A times the trace A minus 1 delta A. Okay, this is just the mass identity here. And this is valid for any matrix, linear algebra. Okay, so let us apply this identity to, so we want to vary delta of square root of determinant of metric. Okay, so let's do it. Where do I go here? So you want to calculate delta of square root of g. Well, you are differentiating the square root, so it's 1/2, 1 over square root of g, and delta of g. And so this is 1/2 square root of g, and it's delta of determinant of the metric, which is determinant of the metric, which is g, times the trace. Now inverse of the metric is a metric with indices upstairs. So g alpha beta, and then delta of the metric g beta gamma. Okay, so there's a matrix multiplication here. So there's a dot here. So you really multiply a minus 1 and delta a. Okay, but of course trace is that if I understand this as matrix, which is a alpha gamma, and if you take the trace of that, you just turn alpha and gamma are the same things, right? So this guy is actually, this thing is just g alpha beta d g, and now this is symmetric, so I can also put it exchange alpha and beta. Okay. So it's 1/2 square root of g alpha beta delta g alpha beta, which is almost what you want, except that the first term here has the variation of the metric with indices upstairs. There, we have a variation of the metric with indices downstairs. Okay, so to change indices downstairs for upstairs actually costs you a minus sign. I can show you that later if you want to. So if I just want to put these indices up, I get a minus sign, square root of g alpha beta d alpha beta. And it comes from, you can just do it yourself. If I just use the definition of the inverse metric, and you differentiate this relation here, that's probably about it. Then you get how to relate this guy with that guy here. Okay, interesting. Well, so everybody happy so far? Well, so then if you put one and two together, then what are you getting? So this is equal to 1 over, okay, see here? 16 pi g newton d4 of x. Now I will take square root of g outside here. And then what remains here is r alpha beta from here. And then this guy is minus 1/2 g alpha beta and r, which comes from here, and delta g alpha beta. Okay, is this, everybody happy with this? And then you have plus term 3. Okay, now, so now obviously if you're looking at this thing here, and that thing over there, you see that it already gives you the left-hand side of the Einstein equation. Okay, so this is actually what we need. So by requiring that the action is stationary, meaning setting this equal to 0, if this guy is not here, it implies that this guy is equal to 0, which means vacuum Einstein equation. Okay? So if the third term doesn't contribute, then we are done. Okay, so now I told you the third term is really painful, and it requires lots of calculation. Is it fixed? Maybe. So finally, the third term, and I will not do the calculation here, it's several pages actually to do it. But of course, it can be shown that it doesn't contribute, because you already recovered what you wanted. So it's no surprise that it doesn't contribute. So what about 3? And it can be shown that it gives a total derivative . So it actually reads B4x. After pages of calculations, you can show that it's written as nabla alpha. V alpha is a divergence of a vector. And this vector, V alpha, is written as nabla beta delta g beta alpha, and then minus g gamma delta nabla alpha delta g gamma delta. Okay, so this is a long calculation, but of course, if the third term can be written as this guy, that means that you can use Stokes' theorem, you can turn it to a boundary integral. Okay, so it doesn't contribute anywhere inside your manifold, but it only contributes on its boundary of that manifold. So by Stokes' theorem, gives surface term . So by the way, well, Stokes' theorem is nothing else than, if you, for example, if you integrate a simple thing from A to B, and I integrate the derivative of a function, and it's just fb minus fa, I hope. So that means that you just evaluate the function on the boundary of your interval. So you have interval from A to B, but only, you know, the boundary terms f at B and f at A contribute. So in the same way, this is a higher dimensional generalization of that. So if I have some domain omega, then I can turn this to a surface integral and only contribute to on this boundary thing. So it's not a domain contribution, and that's why it doesn't contribute to Einstein equations inside. inside that boundary. So the third term is really, you know, you can forget about it. Okay? And so we recovered. So third term doesn't contribute, and that's why we recover vacuum Einstein equation. Questions? Yes?
The reason why it doesn't contribute is because we don't vary the metric on the boundary.
Exactly, exactly. So, okay. Remember that question. It's a very interesting question. So, but yeah, that's right. So you usually, if you consider a variational problem, you fix what happens on the endpoints, and you consider only variations in between. So that's why it doesn't contribute. Yeah. So, much time I have? I have lots of time. That's great. So we need this one. We don't need that one. It's here. So this was basically without any matter, but to add matter is now very simple. So once you know what the gravity side of your action looks like, and then it gives you the right left-hand side of the Einstein equations, to add matter is very simple. So part C is adding matter and basically, so your whole action of not only the gravitational field but plus the matter is given by 16 pi g newton g4 of x square root of g. That's the part we already know, the Einstein-Hilbert part, and then plus whatever the action for the matter, where this is the Lagrangian density for the matter fields. Okay. So again, if you vary this, so delta g alpha beta, then your delta s, using the previous result, is d4 of x square root of g. Now the first part, which you already calculated, is just 1 over 16 pi g newton, and this thing, and that's the Einstein tensor, big g alpha beta. Okay, g alpha beta. So that comes from varying this guy here. And then we have to also vary this guy, the other guy. Okay, so okay, let me write it. I'll borrow minus 2 and I'll return minus 1 half. So I'll write it as minus 1 half and then minus 2, so I haven't done anything. And then you will vary this thing here, square root of g and L matter, with respect to the metric. And this is what I have to do, right? Just borrowing this minus 2, 1 half, and then I have to vary this with respect to the metric, and that's what was written here. Okay, so now this thing people call t alpha beta.
You already had the square root of g, right? In
the integral? Ah, right. Thank you so much. Square root of g. I've put square root of g here, so I have to divide by square root of g here. As well, thank you so much. Very good. So this, so without this 1/2, this is what people call the energy momentum tensor for the matter. And so, I taking the minus 1/2, you just get whatever the Einstein equation is written there, right? So I just put 1 over 16 pi g newton d4 of x square root of g, and I have g alpha beta minus 8 pi g newton t alpha beta delta g alpha beta. And so you require this equal to 0, and there's only one possibility that this guy is equal to 0, and that's your Einstein equation. Okay, so adding matter is very, very simple once you know the Einstein-Hilbert action. And basically, you know, it's all part of this definition. So really, given the Lagrangian for the matter, you can calculate what t alpha beta is. I don't know if there is a problem on this. Next lecture. Okay. Okay, so just a few examples of what L-matter can be. So example, you know, the Higgs field is actually a scalar field. So that's the simplest one. So we have already seen Lagrangian for scalar in special relativity, which was the one I wrote before. But in general relativity, we just promote the special, the normal derivatives to covariant derivatives. So this is your scalar field. And then this is your massless Lagrangian for the scalar field. Okay, and there's a minus sign here. Okay, you may add more interesting field, which is, for example, the electromagnetic field. Yes?
For scalar, isn't the covariant derivative same as?
It is, yeah. Yeah, it's good. Yeah. Very good. Okay, the electromagnetic field. One over 4 pi, the field strength, and so this is like E and B components of the electric field, F mu nu, basically. And this thing is like really electromagnetic energy, so it's E square plus B square. That's what it is, if you write it in terms of three notations. So that's for electromagnetic field. Finally, for cosmological constant, which you will be mostly interested in the next lecture. Constant L matter is just minus 2 lambda over 16 pi g newton. Okay, so lambda is a constant here, and this is your matter Lagrangian. So you can understand cosmological constant. You can put it on the left-hand side and understand it as a part of the Einstein equation, but you can also put it on the right-hand side and understand it as a matter. Okay, so it's like all penetrating matter in the universe. Okay, questions?
So the earlier question about say charged particles and things having their own internal dynamics, that's all encompassed in this L matter, I think.
Yeah, so you would have
the reason why this takes care of those.
In some sense, yes. Yeah. What questions? So now two fancy remarks. Oh, it's just, well, so that's the origin of this 8 pi gn, g newton here. And so, of course, there could be some constant alpha here, which you need to find basically so that it corresponds to Newtonian gravity and experiment. So T mu nu contains, so T 0, 0 component is something like energy density of the matter. Okay, and this thing, well, it's hard to tell what it is, but it's something like, so if you do non-relativistic approximation, you get something like Laplace on phi equals to this thing here, where phi is the Newtonian potential. So it's basically gm over r or something, gm square over r or something like that. So then you are comparing this thing with Newton's law, basically, or with Poisson equation. And that's how you fix whatever the constant here, alpha, has to stand here. So that's basically fixed by you want to match this into Newtonian gravity.
So there's an 8 pi mismatch between the two constants, right? So I'm wondering, like, is that coming from the surface area of a sphere or twice that?
So this is in 4 dimensions. Yeah. People usually write Einstein equations in all dimensions, like 8 pi, and so they just insist, I think, it probably, I think it's related to the area of the sphere, but right. But people don't change this factor. They always, you know, insist that in any dimension, this is true, but I think it's just more like a historical convention,
right,
probably.
I see.
Yeah.
So, can you take a limit where, like, gravity gravity, like, doesn't matter in your dynamics, for example? Like, so I see if you take E to like a very large number, then the second term, the first term disappears in some sense. So is there a limit in which like you recover the dynamics that doesn't include ER?
Well, the simplest way, okay, so very good. So what I was doing, so this is the action for matter and gravity. And so now this action actually depends on my metric, but also on my fields. Right? So the fields are hiding here or whatever. So now I did only one part of the business. I varied the action with respect to the metric. And that should give me the equations of motion for the metric, for Einstein equations. If you vary this action with respect to the field, then you should get the equations of motion for the field. Again, I claim that you can recover those by basically looking at this equation and taking the Bianchi identity. But most of the cases, you can. But anyway, so yeah, you can do it, and you can vary with respect to fields, and you get equations of motion for the field. And then you can set, you know, metric equal to zero, well, to flat metric, and then you get normal field theory as you know it. Yeah. By the way, while you are interested in, so this is a definition of energy momentum tensor. In field theory, people define energy momentum tensor as a conserved quantity with respect to some background symmetries of the flat space. So basically, if I have translation invariants, I can derive the T mu from there. So now this T mu has many advantages with respect to that T mu. First of all, it's automatically symmetric because alpha and beta are actually symmetric. So it's much nicer. And it also, so what people usually do, even in field theory, when they want, you know, nice team you knew, is that they promote the field theory to gravity. They promote eta mu nu to g mu nu everywhere. Then they find the metric, the energy momentum tensor from this prescription, and then they switch off to gravity again. And that gives you nice energy momentum tensor, much nicer than the Noether's procedure. You can always upgrade your Noether's current, your Noether's team you knew, to a symmetric one. But it's painful procedure usually. For example, for electromagnetism, painful procedure. Okay, so now time is almost up. So should I have two remarks? So I can give you very sketchy, quick. And I still have V alpha there, so which is, so part D is two remarks. And the first one is the famous Gibbons-Hawking term. And that is actually, you know, asking a question, is this variational principle actually well posed and nicely done? Or have I been actually lying to you all the time? And basically, I was lying to you. So here is your space-time, and you know, some manifold M, and then there's a metric living on this manifold here. But suppose that this space-time actually has some boundary. So there's this guy here, and that's my boundary of the space-time. Okay. So now the problem is that third term which we have sort of thrown away. So term three. And if you look at it here, it's still over here. So it's a divergence of a vector. But if you look at what this vector actually looks like, it actually contains a derivative of delta of g. So now delta and derivative commute as always in these things. So you have actually a delta of the derivative of the metric. Okay. So term three means that you need to prescribe. Well, not only the variation of the metric on the boundary, as always you have to do, but also to kill this term on the boundary, you have to also prescribe the derivative of the metric on the boundary. So also delta of nabla of g of dm equals to 0. To really kill this term, you need to say that this on the boundary vanishes, that V alpha vanishes on the boundary. But V alpha contains this derivative of delta of G. Okay? So this is something like prescribing, if you have normal variational principle, you have to prescribe not only that delta Q on the endpoints is 0, but also delta Q dot on these things is equal to 0. But if you studied partial differential equations, you know that this is impossible. So this is not possible. And the problem is ill-posed. So actually, if you do that, you never find a solution. You are prescribing too many boundary conditions, and they will kill all the solutions, unless they are fine-tuned and they really match the exact solution. So this is ill-posed. And so really, the term 3 is a problem, although I was pretending it is not. But it is a problem. And so to get rid of that term, you actually have to add the boundary term, which kills this term number 3. And then you have the right variational principle. So you kill the term number 3 by putting an extra term into the action. And so the correct action for GR is actually the Einstein-Hilbert action. And then I have d4x square root of GR. And then plus this Gibbons-Hawking term, and this is d3 of x square root of h and k. So this is the correct action for GR. So now this guy we already know. So now we are integrating over the boundary. So we are killing one dimension. So that's why we integrate over d3 of x. Now, if this is the metric in the bulk, g, then h is the metric, induced metric on the boundary. So it's just a three-dimensional metric on the boundary, on the three-dimensional boundary. And k is the extrinsic curvature of the boundary. So this is the extrinsic curvature. So basically, it measures, well, if I have some curved surface and I make a normal, it measures how this normal changes, how it changes the direction. So if I have, you know, flat surface, the normal is always the same, so the extrinsic curvature is actually 0. But if I have, for example, this thing, then the normal changes the direction and I have non-trivial curvature. So that's what k means. So it really measures how this boundary is curved in your spacetime. So this is the correct action. And really, the meaning of this thing here is to precisely kill this term. And this term can be nicely written as this curvature term. Questions? Anybody seems puzzled?
So what if you don't have boundaries?
If you send boundary to infinity, I think you're fine. I think you're fine. But the problem is that, well, these are the problems. OK.
or what if your manifold has no boundary?
Most of the time you're fine, but the problem is, okay, so if you are just interested in equations of motion, there's no problem whatsoever. If you are interested in quantum gravity, you need to evaluate this action. You need to find what the actual value of the action is. And this usually diverges. If there is no boundary, let's say the radius can go all the way to infinity, you usually find that the action is proportional to this radius or something like that. So you have to basically regularize. You have to say, well, I cut my thing somewhere. Yeah, so thank you for that question. So, yes?
Does this tell us that if you can make precise enough measurements of things that happen here, we can tell something about the curvature of?
It's a tricky question. Let me think about it. it's a good question. So anyway, so this has two consequences. So first of all, you can make the boundary dynamical, and you know, people study, for example, the brains or whatever. So you have some brains floating in your higher dimensional space, and probably it will be mentioned in this. But anyway, so this thing actually then, you know, is dynamical quantity and can change. And the other thing is precisely what you ask. So if I add this Gibbons-Hawking term, it changes the value of the action. On a solution. So if I have a particular solution of Einstein equation, I can just, you know, plug it in. I can find, you know, what this action actually, what is the value of the action. And why this is interesting is that the statement is that the true quantum gravity is given by the, you know, pass integral over all the metrics of the Euclidean action evaluated on the metric, which in the first approximation is just evaluated on the classical solution, e to minus se. So now, so this really is the value of the action on a given solution, right? So if I add this term, it changes the value. So it's actually, you know, it's important in some sense. It gives you different quantum theory. Yes?
So what if you threw out that term, or added some other boundary term?
Well, there's not so.
As a quantum, I mean, why do we even have to think about saddle point operations? Is that there? Is there some other way to say that the theory is sick?
Well, definitely the well, classically it's sick because you cannot find, you know, formulate the correct variational principle, right? So this is one way how you actually can formulate, you know, a nice variational principle at least in classical theory. Right, so that's a classical reason. The quantum reason is that you have to. Well, this is still not the whole story. Actually, even after adding this Gibbons-Hawking term, your action can still diverge and can still, you know, have problems. And this happens in ADS space. So people then add so-called counter terms to actually make the action even, you know, better and nicely formulated. How much is this unique? I don't know. I don't think it's actually very unique, but. Yeah, that's what people do. It's basically like you are choosing regularization in your field theory, but how much is this is actually, you know, independent of how you regularize, I don't know.
Is k a function of the original metric tensor?
Is?
K the extrinsic curvature?
Yeah.
Is it a function of the original metric tensor?
In some sense, yes, exactly. It's a function of this induced metric H. Which actually, so you take the metric, you project it on your boundary, and that gives you H, the metric H alpha beta.
So when you vary that, don't you have more boundary terms, like boundary over boundary or something like that?
Well, this is a closed boundary, so there's no boundary of the boundary. Yeah. But yeah. What was the question?
I was wondering if, when reducing the metric on the boundary H, is that unique? Or is it well-defined everywhere?
Well, if you fix the boundary, yeah. So your metric G gives you a unique, well, unless, you know, depends on the character of the boundary. But if the boundary is nice, then this H is unique. Yeah, but if you have, for example, you know, null boundary, which is like, you know, you can have time-like or space-like or null. So null boundaries are very problematic, and the metric is not unique. Can I have 3 minutes more to tell you about higher curvature gravities? Okay. It will really be, well, probably 5 minutes. So remark two is higher curvature gravity and. So this question was already here. So basically, we chosen the Lagrangian density to be equal to this Ricci scale R, which is the simplest possible choice you can have. But somebody asked, you know, can I have function of R? And the answer is yes, you can. So the choice L equal to R is just the simplest one. But you know, you can add, these higher curvature terms, So for example, I can consider this thing, and then I can add anything I want. So alpha R square, so this particular function of R, or beta. R alpha beta are alpha, beta. Why not? Or gamma, derivative of the Ricci scalar, derivative of the Ricci scalar, and so on. So you can add, you know, all possible higher curvature terms if you want. And you know, this thing, it was just the simplest possible choice. Okay, so yes, you can do it. And people do add these higher curvature terms sort of to mimic quantum gravity. So it's like if you heard about the normalization group, if you want to probe higher energies or whatever, then you know that the coupling constants get changed and you can generate new coupling constants in your field theory. So actually, there is an expectation that even if you start with the Einstein-Hilbert action, just with this term, you know, in quantum effects, we'll add these other terms. Right, so these higher curvature terms sort of mimic quantum gravity, and that's the motivation. Okay, but the problem is these things, classically, problem is that actually, if you write down the equations of motion following from this action, there won't be any more second order equations of motion. There'll be higher order equations of motion. So generically, higher order equations of motion, which is a problem. So probably you have heard about Dirac, Lorentz-Dirac equation, maybe in electromagnetism. So that's a fourth order equation of motion. So instead of q double dot equals to something, I have q, you know, four dots equals to something. And so usually these equations have very, very ill-behaved solutions. So for example, you may have an electron here, which sits here happily, and suddenly starts accelerating, and is not happy until it accelerates at the speed of light away from you. And that solution exists, for example, if you have higher order equations of motion. So similarly, you know, classically you have problems if you have equations of motion which are more than second order. Okay, and so these theories, if you start adding additional terms, they always be of higher order equations, up to some very special tuning. And that very special tuning is called level of gravity. So just final remark. So you can fine tune these things. So special class of these higher curvature theories is called level of gravity. And it's the most general theory which actually has second order equations of motion. And the Lagrangian is written as 1 over 16 pi g Newton, and there is a sum. Alpha k are just the expansion constants, so level of coupling constants, if you want. And what stands here is the Lagrangian densities, which are special, it's called Euler densities. So that sounds fancy. What it is actually a combination of Riemann tensors. So LK is given some antisymmetrization. So delta A1, B1, AK, BK, C1, D1, CK, DK. So don't worry if you. And then I have the Riemanns. So I have C1, D1, P1. And then there's many Riemann tensors, the product of them, CK, DK, AK, BK. So basically, you take a product of Riemann tensors, and that, you know, so this is an antisymmetric symbol. It just antisymmetrizes all the possible indices. And then you can take, that gives you given Euler density of order K, and you can sum of all these Euler densities. So in particular, L0 actually gives you the lambda term. L1 gives you the Einstein-Hilbert. And L2 gives you so-called Gauss-Bonnet gravity. But anyway, So this is the unique theory, which sort of generalizes the Einstein theory. But the problem is that these Euler densities are sort of do not contribute to equations of motion if you are sufficiently low dimension. If you are in four dimensions, all k's bigger than one actually are identically zero, but they don't give you anything new. They don't change the equations of motion. So to get, for example, non-trivial Gauss-Bonnet theory, you have to go to five dimensions. Okay, so these are non-trivial in higher dimensions. And in four dimensions, they just reduce to Einstein gravity. So the Lovelock theory, in some sense, is a natural generalization of Einstein theory into higher dimensions, if you want. It gives you nice second-order equations of motion. Many properties of the theory are the same as of Einstein theory. OK, so let me finish here. Questions?
Do you believe in quantum?
Well, why not? So these things are actually, you know, these are arbitrary, but the combination here of the Riemann tensors is fixed. So for example, the Gauss-Bonnet theorem is something like, well, whatever I had here, I have, let's say, alpha r squared, beta r alpha beta. So now this alpha and beta would have to be precisely something. So let's say one here and 1/5 here. And then I will have another term, r alpha beta gamma delta square. And again, that will be precise tuning here. And that will be the Euler density. So it must be really, really fine tuned. Yes. But in some sense, it is like an Einstein theory. So here you have sort of like, well, OK, I'll stop here. I will not say anything.
In principle, there is no problem with that theory if you treat it conservatively, right?
Well, you cannot quantize it perturbatively. Because what actually happens is that the G Newton actually has the wrong dimensions, so it's actually non-renormalizable theory.
But that's perfect.
You can treat it as ineffective. Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for coming, and see you Wednesday.